From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, New York Times reporter Ralph Blumenthal on the biggest criminal investigation in FBI history. Blumenthal's just written a new book explaining how the Bureau broke up the Sicilian drug operation known as the Pizza Connection. Also today, I speak with filmmaker Errol Morris. His new documentary, The Thin Blue Line, investigates the murder of a Dallas police officer. Michael Cooney is featured in our weekly performance spot with a couple of old love songs. And critic at large Laurie Stone reviews the work of up-and-coming political humorist Lewis Black. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The largest criminal investigation ever undertaken by the FBI exposed what came to be known as the Pizza Connection, a mafia-controlled heroin pipeline from Sicily to the U.S. The FBI's war against this drug ring culminated in a 17-month trial that began on October 24, 1985. 22 mafia members, nearly all of them in the food and pizza business, were accused of participating in a $1.65 billion heroin smuggling and money laundering conspiracy. New York Times investigative reporter Ralph Blumenthal covered the trial. He's written a new book about the history of this mafia drug pipeline and how the FBI penetrated it. It's called Last Days of the Sicilians. There's a commonly held belief that the mafia was at one time reluctant to deal in drugs, but Blumenthal says that's a vast misconception.
Yes, there was some reluctance on the part of some American mafia leaders, bosses, to steer clear of drugs for very pragmatic reasons. It got them into trouble. It attracted attention of the authorities. Morally, I think their compunctions, if they had any, had less to do with it. But that is a myth. They were into drugs. As soon as drugs started to boom, members of all families and the bosses were into it, and into it deeply in this country. Sicily felt no compunctions at all. They were into the drug traffic almost immediately on the heels of tobacco smuggling. When tobacco smuggling went down and became less lucrative because of changes in Italian law and patterns of commerce, drugs took their place.
The Pizza Connection starts the way you describe it, with the murder of Carmine Galante, who was a chieftain of the Bonanno family, one of New York's five families.
Right.
And he was dominating the heroin market in the United States.
Right.
And you say he used to charge a $500, quote, license fee per
kilo. $5,000,
yes. $5,000 per kilo of heroin. Would you explain how that worked?
Okay. That's kind of shorthand. There was obviously no formal license. People didn't apply for it. There's no paperwork in the mafia. But he made himself the traffic cop of the heroin traffic in America. What he tried to do is put buyers and sellers together and exact a fee. And while $5,000 a kilo may not sound like much in view of the millions and billions that the traffic amounted to, when you realize that thousands of kilos were going back and forth and some of them were being intercepted by the authorities, it came to quite a lot of money, and this is apart from whatever traffic he himself would run. So he was charging the families $5,000 a kilo to arrange, to allow the stuff into the country, and to put buyers and sellers together.
Who knocked him off, and what do you think the motivation was?
Well, as I point out in the Last Days of the Sicilians, it seemed to have been a plot by other members of the Bonanno family, a Sicilian cabal within the Bonanno family, including two of Galante's own dining companions at the Joe and Mary Italian restaurant in Brooklyn on Knickerbocker Avenue. If you can remember back, it was a summer almost as sweltering as this one, in 1979. It was a very, very hot day, and Galante went to have lunch with a couple of friends and two of his bodyguards at the time, Cesare Bonventri and Baldo Amato. And while he was eating in the backyard garden of tomato vines, three masked gunmen wearing ski masks burst in with shotguns and pistols and killed him. And miraculously, his two bodyguards escaped, although two other dining companions with Galante were murdered. And it was a mystery almost from the beginning how these two escaped while everybody else was slaughtered. And the reason became apparent not too long after, that they seemed to have been in on it from the pattern of shots, from the way they escaped, as one of the prosecutors said afterwards, it rained bullets and they didn't get wet.
No, you think that the mafia wanted to kill him so that the heroin market would be more accessible to others?
I think certain elements of the mafia wanted to get in on it. I think the Sicilians were feeling their oats, and while Galante himself was a Sicilian, see, this is very, very complicated. What's Sicilian and what's American? Because some so-called American mobsters came from Sicily, and yet, although Galante came from Castellammare, which is a very venerable fishing village west of Palermo, where Joe Bonanno came from and a lot of other Bonanno mobsters came from, Galante really grew up in the American mafia. He was an assistant to Joe Bonanno in the early days of the Bonanno's regency, and Galante went to Canada to organize the rackets for Bonanno in Canada. And he was, you might say, really part of the American mafia. But within this family, there was a Sicilian group, a Sicilian faction that no one even knew existed. The FBI, with all their eavesdropping and all their surveillance and all their experts, and were caught totally off guard when this faction surfaced. And it was this faction, investigators now believe, and I show in my book, that seemed to have made a move at that crucial time to take the heroin racket away from Galante.
My guest is New York Times reporter Ralph Blumenthal, who's the author of the new book, Last Days of the Sicilians at War with the Mafia, and it's about the so-called pizza connection. Now, the murder of Galante makes it possible for this pizza connection to get into place. Let's talk about what this pipeline is of drugs from Sicily to America. First of all, how is this pipeline established?
Well, the pipeline really took over the old tobacco smuggling routes. This was not anything that was put in place overnight.
Mm-hmm.
It grew up historically out of trade routes, trade of contraband, going back to right after the war. During the war, there was very little trade in anything contraband because all the ships were being used for the war effort. So that was a time when heroin, the number of heroin addicts in the United States, by the way, plummeted to 20,000 from today's estimated 500,000. So drug trafficking was just about wiped out during the war. So we're starting now after the war, as commerce reestablishes itself, ships can get back into civilian use, and the Italian mafia, reinstalled, by the way, by the American conquerors of Italy, the victorious American troops looking around for allies, seized on the mafia, which had been just about wiped out, decimated by Mussolini, probably the only good thing Mussolini ever did. These mafia bosses and their underlings now come out of hiding, the ones that were still left alive, and they start to reestablish themselves in the tobacco smuggling business, which was a very, very hot item after the war. You can remember that tobacco was a currency after the war, much in demand, and anyone who could smuggle cigarettes was in fact smuggling gold or currency. And that worked until the early 60s, and with the worldwide traffic in cigarettes becoming less and less important, cigarettes were no longer such a prized commodity. They were available everywhere. There were factories in Italy making them. These same mafia bosses and factions decided that they could shift very easily into drugs. The American appetite for drugs was insatiable, and it became obvious very quickly that this was the way to make money. So they took the old tobacco smuggling routes and just used them now for drugs. And the network was an incredibly complicated and sophisticated one, reaching from Bulgaria, Turkey, to Sicily, to Marseille in the days of the French Connection, the Corsicans out of Marseille, certainly to Southeast Asia in the days of the French occupation of Indochina, and which is where a lot of the morphine base and the heroin and the opium poppies came from, all the way to the United States, which was the end of that line.
When the Sicilians sent the heroin to the mafia in the United States, how was it concealed? What were some of the inventive ways they used to actually smuggle the stuff in?
Terry, it's almost easier to talk about how they didn't conceal it. It was found, and that's the only thing we know. We don't know how it was concealed and not found. It was found in espresso machines, in shoes, tomato cans. It was found, they concocted one especially ingenious method in olive oil cans. They would take an olive oil can, inside solder a smaller can a little bit off-center that would have the heroin and seal it. And the rest of the can had olive oil. So the customs people in America, when they would test these cans, and they were pretty sophisticated themselves, they would drop a probe, like a stick or so, into the can, and they'd hit oil, olive oil, and they figured the can was all right, not realizing that just off-center was another can with the heroin soldered into it. But then they caught on to that, so the mafia figured out other ways to do it. They body couriered it in. One of the characters I feature in The Last Days of the Sicilians is a very colorful hitman named Luigi Roncesvalli, who describes in some detail how he was tutored in body couriering in heroin around the country, actually after it had come in, and they told him, put it on your body, and then rush for a plane at the last minute with a bundle full of luggage and coats and things. And if you're rushing to the plane at the last minute, your arms are full of bundles, it's less likely you'll be stopped. And in fact, he smuggled into different parts of the country about $150 million worth of heroin.
Now, where does the pizza in the pizza connection come in?
Okay, well, your pizza is safe. There is no heroin in the pizza. And I think that was an early misconception by the name. Pizza parlors were used as fronts.
Mm-hmm.
They were convenient cash businesses. They generated a lot of cash. There was a lot of traffic in and out. People could move back and forth without attracting much attention. They were always getting deliveries. So it was a good way to hide the traffic itself and to hide the cash. But there was certainly no drugs mixed in with the pizza.
Now, you have a photo. You have a lot of photos in your book that the FBI took during surveillance. One of the photos is of someone in the American mafia going into another mafia member's house with a gift-wrapped box that actually contained $250,000. Then a few minutes later, the person walks out with a blue shirt box containing 1 kilo of heroin. Was this a kind of typical transaction?
It is, and it is atypical in that this was a transaction almost completely recorded on videotape and film by the FBI, which made it so extraordinary. These kind of things happen, but they're rarely recorded so perfectly and to such devastating effect. And it was kind of funny how the FBI did this, as I describe in the book. Middle-level drug dealer in Philadelphia named Benny Zito was dealing with the top guys in New York who were actually bringing in the stuff, the real leaders of the Sicilian Mafia in New York. And Zito, unbeknownst to him, of course, was dealing with an undercover agent in Philadelphia. And the undercover agent asked him if Zito could get him some drugs, and Zito said yes. And they fixed the price at $250,000 a kilo, which was a fairly representative price at that time. The agent then, it's a DEA agent named Steve Hobson, packed the money up in a box with a teddy bear wrapping so it would show up nicely on the surreptitious FBI pictures. And sure enough, because the phones were all tapped, Zito is seen coming up to the house of his supplier with the teddy bear box of the $250,000. He goes in, and very few minutes later, he comes out with a blue shirt box containing, they later established, the heroin. And then there's this incredible moment that's captured on the videotape and in photographs. As Zito comes out with the kilo of heroin under his arm, in the blue shirt box, he stoops down and kisses the daughter of the mafia kingpin he's just bought the heroin from, who's about 7 years old at the time. And it was an absolutely chilling moment in the courtroom when that video was shown to show this man. It showed the hypocrisy and the insidiousness of these people. On the one hand, pretending to be solicitous of the youth and kissing this little girl with enough drugs there to kill a whole generation of other kids.
Can I ask you briefly to describe how the money was gotten out of America into the Swiss bank accounts? How the money was laundered?
Almost as many ways, Terry, as the drugs
came
in.
As it was smuggled in, right?
They were incredibly ingenious. And one thing you have to remember about these people, and the FBI speaks of this often, is that they're absolutely tireless. While you and I knock off for the weekend or take an evening off, these guys are thinking every waking minute and often through the night of how they can make a buck. And often it's only a buck. They don't care how much or little it is, but they are scheming tirelessly. And it's often been said, if they ever put their talents to legitimate business, these guys could be blockbuster businessmen. But in terms of getting out the money, they were equally ingenious as getting the drugs in. They dealt with, at first they were rather unsophisticated. They would just take a bag of money, $100,000, $200,000, and catch a Swiss Air flight out of the country, and just deliver the bag at the other end. And at one point, as I say, in Last Days of the Sicilians, the Swiss customs people stop a guy carrying a suitcase with $2 million cash out of the country. And they open up his suitcase, and they see all this money, and all the other Swiss officers come running, and they start to count it. And after $1 million, they give up, and they figure, well, this has a million. The other is of equal size. It also must have a million. So we'll just put it down as 2 million, and then they let him go. They didn't care. He was bringing the money into Switzerland, and that was okay with them. But that was the old way, just carrying bags of money. Eventually, they were making so much money that they could not physically manage to carry it out of the country. It became literally tons of money. So they had to get rid of it through brokerage houses here in New York, and they then engaged in a very complex series of dealings with big brokerage houses, Merrill Lynch, E.F. Hutton, and others, who took their cash, no questions asked, for a very long time, which enraged the Justice Department when it came out. And through these brokerage houses, the money was deposited here and then wired to Switzerland and into Swiss accounts and credited in Switzerland.
Well, I want to talk with you about the role of the FBI in cracking this pizza connection. But first, we have to take a short break. My guest is Ralph Blumenthal, who's a reporter with The New York Times. And we're discussing the subject of his new book, The Last Days of the Sicilians at War with the Mafia, the FBI Assault on the Pizza Connection. We'll be back in just a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Ralph Blumenthal is the author of The Last Days of the Sicilian, which tells about how the FBI went about their biggest criminal investigation ever, how they broke the heroin pipeline from the Sicilian Mafia to the American Mafia. Now, you describe the FBI as being determined to this time around not just get a chieftain and a couple of soldiers, but to really break a ring. What are some of the key things that they did differently in this investigation than they'd done in previous attempts to deal with the Mafia?
Well, they held themselves back initially. The instinct of every law enforcement agency, and it's certainly a good one, is when you see wrongdoing going on or you find out who's bringing in a load of heroin, is to grab them. In recent years, it became obvious that this wasn't working. Every time you grabbed somebody, you grabbed the lower-level echelon, and the kingpins were free to set up another operation all over again. So that wasn't working. The DEA and the FBI realized, even before they joined forces legally in 1982, that they had to build on the information, the intelligence that they'd been getting over the years, and try to attack the upper echelon to find out where this stuff was coming from and who was behind it. And I think that is the genius of this case. What made this case different, not just the 100,000 wiretapped conversations or the 400 agents who participated at the end in the arrests, the 1,000 rolls of film that were shot during the surveillances, but the fact that they were putting together a picture of a vast network stretching from the streets of Brooklyn to Bulgaria and Turkey, and where the stuff was originating. And they were compiling an incredible intelligence base of who these people were, in conjunction with the Italian police, who were very helpful. It was really the first time the Americans and the Italians collaborated to this extent. They put together an incredible detailed picture, not all of which even came out in the trial, but that was the genius of this case.
Now, did they use RICO, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, to help indict everybody on as a conspiracy as opposed to as individuals?
Yes, that was a key part of this thing. What RICO made it possible to do is to bring in a whole network and not to focus on individual cases. This guy handled this bit of drugs, therefore we're arresting him for that. But if a group of people get together and conspire over a long period of time, you can charge everybody with a conspiracy, even if somebody had kind of a marginal role in it, if you can prove that they were part of the conspiracy. And that's what the government did.
I think one of the keys in an investigation like this is knowing when it's time to move in and break the case open and start arresting people. Because if you move too soon, then you're not going to have enough evidence, and maybe you'll indict a few people, but you won't get a whole ring. When was the moment right? What made the moment right?
Well, you know, that's a good point, Terry, but they didn't know when the moment was, mm-hmm. and you never do, of course. It's mm-hmm. like life itself. You never know when the right time is to do anything. You got to take a guess. And towards the end of the book, as I describe, I think in some detail, FBI was tormented by the question of when to bring this thing down. And there were numerous opportunities to do it. They were waiting for one key shipment to come in from Florida, brought in by Gaetano Badalamenti, who was the ousted boss of the Sicilian Mafia, the boss of bosses of the Sicilian Mafia, a very, very fearsome character who was in exile in Brazil. He'd been kicked out of the Mafia for some unspecified insult. And he was down in Brazil, and he was trying to reconstitute or resuscitate his drug network from Brazil. And he was sending a load up. All the FBI knew was that it was 22 containers. They weren't sure of what. And that it was coming into Florida because they had the lines tapped. And they kind of made up their mind that they would seize this load when it came in. But there were people who argued against it. And there was, as a matter of fact, as I say in the book, there was quite a dispute and an angry dispute within the Justice Department over whether to take this load down if they could. There were some people in Washington who urged that the load, which they figured out by then was 22 kilos of cocaine, be allowed into the country in order to trace the network further. And some of the agents here on the spot, supervisors too, said, no way, because if this stuff gets into the country and we lose it, it'll be our butts. No ifs, ands, or buts. It'll be our butts. And they said no, and they were ordered by Washington, you let this stuff into the country, which is quite an interesting reflection on the seriousness of this investigation. And there were officials in Washington who were willing to take the heat. As it turned out, the negotiations collapsed, and this stuff didn't come into the country then, so they didn't have to confront the issue. But it was a thorny question all along, and when they decided to break it up is when this stuff turned out not to come into the country, but one of the key figures in America, one of the key middlemen to this Gaetano Badalamenti in exile in Brazil, when this guy went to see his uncle in Madrid, as it turned out, he had gone from Brazil to Madrid, and he was followed. And the FBI figured if they could follow him to Badalamenti, his uncle, in Madrid, and arrest Badalamenti, that would be the time to bring it down. And that's exactly what happened.
How many guys were actually put away when the case concluded?
Well, let's see. 18 were put away. They started with 22. One was killed during the trial. One was shot and badly wounded. One died of cancer. And one was acquitted. And I think that ends up to 18.
Do you think that the Sicilian-American pizza connection is over?
No, I don't. Uh-huh. I think, as a matter of fact, last spring, which would have been a year after the pizza connection was broken, or at least after the verdicts came in and everybody was sentenced to long prison terms, a second round of arrests took place, and it's now been called Pizza 2. It didn't have the magnitude or the depth of the original Pizza Connection, but it was conveniently called Pizza 2 because some of the same characters surfaced in both investigations. There may be a Pizza 3 ahead.
You know, I think it's probably a depressing truth that even if this Pizza Connection had been totally busted, that there'd be another group to move in and fill the void.
Yes, that's true. You know, often prosecutors are asked, and I'm asked, well, what does this mean for drugs? Will there be less drugs in the country? And sadly, you're right. There are always other groups waiting to take on the traffic. But this group, and it was a very sophisticated group, is out of commission. And it's going to take another group some time to develop the same mechanisms and the same smuggling routes and the same expertise. And if they're put out of commission, a third group will have to develop that. And each time the FBI develops more sophisticated methods of tracking them. And, I mean, you know, the bad guys try to always be one step ahead of the FBI, but the FBI is always learning things. And the hope is that the new guys coming along are not going to be as sophisticated. They're going to make more mistakes. And I think that's what's happening. I think it's shifting now. Less experienced people are coming in, and they're going to be easier to catch.
Uh-huh. You know, Shayna Alexander has a book on the Pizza Connection also, focusing mostly on the trial. And she writes in her introduction that she was kind of concerned at this mega trial, a 17-month, $50 million trial, that she had to keep charts and graphs just to figure out who was who, because there were so many people in this cast of characters. And she was concerned, like, how is a jury who isn't even allowed to take notes going to figure out who the people are and what their connection really is? Were you concerned about this kind of thing? You were there at the trial, too,
yes,
covering it for the New York Times.
I was concerned about that in the beginning because I had a terrible time keeping track of the people, and I felt very, very insecure because here I am researching a book on the subject, and I couldn't keep the character straight. I had to go around with a chart, actually, in the courtroom, trying to figure out who was sitting in that seat. That must be so-and-so. And I worried about the jury. But I'll tell you that after 17 months of hearing this testimony and seeing the videos and the FBI witnesses, there was no trouble at all. The jury came to a very, very quick verdict. Under the circumstances, I think they deliberated 5 days, parts of 5 days, which was extraordinarily short for a case of this magnitude. And by their verdicts, and they had to decide some very sophisticated questions. Was this man guilty of masterminding the conspiracy? Did he supervise 5 others? Was this one guilty of these phone calls which facilitated the conspiracy? And going back over the verdict sheet later, you could see that the jury was very, very shrewd in picking out what they convicted people on. And the one guy who was acquitted, it was the son of Badalamenti, who really had only a marginal part in the case. The government argued, I thought persuasively, that he deserved to be convicted also as part of the conspiracy. But acquitting him was not an egregious error.
Only have a couple of seconds left, so I'm just wondering, this case increased your faith in the jury system?
Yes, I would say so. I thought they were a very good jury, and they were not overwhelmed.
One last thing, very briefly. Whatever happened to all the pizza places that were fronts for heroin?
They've kind of changed hands now. It's hard to track them. They've gone probably to some friends, maybe other members of the family. They're not owned by the same people, supposedly, who are in jail, but one can't be sure.
Was this bad for business for pizza parlors in New York?
I don't think so. It kept putting the name of pizza in the headlines every day. I used to get hungry and eat pizza during the recesses, and the FBI agents who were surveilling these places used to order out for pizza from these same places they were surveilling.
That's so great. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been New York Times reporter Ralph Blumenthal. His new book is titled The Last Days of the Sicilians at War with the Mafia, The FBI Assault on the Pizza Connection. It's published by Times Books. Blumenthal is an investigative reporter for the Times, and he's currently working on the Tawana Brawley case. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Kirk Douglas will be my guest on the next Fresh Air. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Randall Dale Adams is in a Texas prison convicted of killing a police officer. Filmmaker Errol Morris thinks Adams is innocent. Morris made the crime and subsequent trial the subject of his latest documentary, The Thin Blue Line. Coming up, a talk with Errol Morris about the film he describes as a real-life episode of The Twilight Zone. Also, folk singer Michael Cooney plays a couple of old pop songs, and critic Large Laurie Stone says there's not much of an arena for political humor these days, but if it makes a comeback, comedian Lewis Black is ready. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. A Pentagon report on the downing of an Iranian airliner by the USS Vincennes last July has cleared its captain and crew of negligence. But NPR's Brenda Wilson reports the Pentagon does say mistakes were made.
According to the report, the Vincennes crew mistakenly identified Iran Air 655 as an F-14 fighter plane, but radio signals transmitted by Flight 655, according to the ship's tapes, were those normally used by commercial planes. The crew also told the captain that the airline was diving towards the ship, when the ship's console indicated that Flight 655 was in fact still climbing. The report noted, however, that the Iranian airliner never identified itself and failed to answer repeated warnings from the ship. The USS Vincennes was under attack from Iranian gunboats at the time. Admiral William Crowell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said the captain had no way of knowing that the airliner was not a part of the fighting going on in the Persian Gulf.
I believe that given the operating environment, Captain Rogers acted reasonably and did what his nation expected of him in the defense of his ship and crew. In all good conscience, I concur with Admiral Fogarty's finding that there was no culpable conduct displayed on board Vincennes.
Admiral William Crowell, I'm Brenda Wilson.
Iran and Iraq have issued challenges to each other less than a day before the United Nations ceasefire between the two is to take effect. Iran says it will continue to inspect ships in the Persian Gulf even after the ceasefire, and Iraq says it will send two of its ships through the Gulf for the first time since the beginning of the 8-year-old Gulf War. NPR's Deborah Amos has more from Baghdad.
Iraqi television reported tonight that the Transportation Ministry has ordered two ships to sail tomorrow to test the ceasefire. One will move from the harbor in Iraq's port city of Basra through the Shatt al-Arab waterway. Control of the waterway has been in dispute. Another Iraqi ship will sail in the southern Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz. Iranian speedboats have attacked tankers in this part of the Gulf. In addition, Iran's Silkworm missiles are based within range. Tonight, the United Nations observers are stationed at their posts to begin duties tomorrow when the ceasefire in the 8-year-long Gulf War begins officially at 7 a.m. In Baghdad, this is Deborah Amos.
Israel is preparing deportation orders against 15 more Palestinians, despite international criticism. Palestinians are accused of membership in activist committees, which the Israeli military accuses of organizing protests and strikes in the occupied territories. The International Committee of the Red Cross issued its second protest in a week to the Israeli government today, calling for an end to the expulsions. And the U.S. agrees the policy is unjust.
Deportation increases Palestinian resentment and thus begets more violence. If individuals have committed criminal acts, they should be brought to trial and punished in accordance with due process.
State Department spokeswoman Phyllis Oakley repeated the Red Cross charge that deportations violate the Geneva Convention. A wildfire which has destroyed 10 houses near Helena, Montana, has grown to more than 27,000 acres, despite the efforts of 1,700 firefighters. But officials say shifting winds have helped ease the threat to about 500 other residents who remain ready to evacuate their homes about 10 miles east of Helena. Fire officials say they're optimistic that cooler weather this weekend could aid the firefight. For the second time in 2 days, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board has announced the consolidation of troubled Texas savings and loans. Today, the bank board said that 8 insolvent Texas thrifts will be joined under one management controlled by the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, which will provide assistance of $2.5 billion. It's hoped that the consolidated institution will eventually be sold. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 11 points, closing the week at 2016. Advances led declines in trading of 122 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 6 cents. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. On this week's Performance Spot, we bring you folk singer Michael Cooney. He's known for keeping thousands of relatively unknown songs alive, like old blues tunes, maritime ballads, and children's songs. Cooney is also known for his fresh interpretations of some very familiar tunes.
Here's a couple of old pop songs from the 1920s. I lived in Canada for the last 10 years, and I learned this one because I felt I ought to learn a French song.
Wonderful, it's wonderful to be in love with you. Beautiful, you're so beautiful, you haunt me all day through. Every little breeze seems to whisper Louise. Birds in the trees seem to twitter Louise. Each little rose tells me it knows I love you, love you. Every little beat that I feel in my heart seems to repeat what I felt at the start. Each little sigh tells me that I adore you, Louise. Just to see and hear you is joy I never knew. But to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise? Every little breeze seems to whisper, birds in the trees seem to twitter, Louise. Each little rose tells me it knows I love you, love you. Every little beat that I feel in my heart seems to repeat what I felt at the start. Each little sigh tells me that I adore you, Louise. Just to see and hear you is joy I never knew, but to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise?
I bet you didn't recognize that song until you heard the main part of it. A lot of these old songs have wonderful introductory verses that never make it onto the record, or especially not onto the sheet music. And I'd like to sing another song that I think is a beautiful song. And when I finally saw the verses that you will never find, I realized that the song said a whole lot more than just the soft shoe song and dance that most versions imply.
Shades of night are falling and I'm lonely, standing on the corner feeling blue. Sweethearts out for fun, pass me one by one. Guess I'll wind up like I always do, with only me and my shadow strolling down the avenue. Me and my shadow, not a soul to tell our troubles to. When I go out at night with my old pal, we never fight about any gal, not me and my shadow all alone. and the sun sets on the far horizon, and the parlor lamps begin to glow. Jim and Jack and John put their slippers on. They're all set, but we're still on the go. So lonely, me and my shadow, strolling down the avenue. Me and my shadow, all alone without a thing to do. And when it's 12 o'clock, we climb the stairs. We never knock, for nobody's there. Just me and my shadow, all alone and feeling blue. Just me and my shadow, all alone and feeling blue.
Folk singer Michael Cooney now lives in Maine. He'll be performing later this month at the Philadelphia Folk Festival. This is Fresh Air. Filmmaker Errol Morris likes to think of himself as a director-detective. That's because in his new film, The Thin Blue Line, he uncovers evidence he believes could save a man's life. The Thin Blue Line is about the 1976 murder of a Dallas policeman and the man charged with the murder. Morris tells the story through a series of interviews, heightened by dramatic techniques borrowed from fiction film. Philip Glass wrote the score for the film. Film critic Jay Hoberman said that Morris's films bear about as much resemblance to an ordinary documentary as a Dolly watch does to a Timex. Errol Morris is attracted to the offbeat in American life. His 1979 film, Gates of Heaven, was about California pet cemeteries. And his 1981 film, Vernon, Florida, featured monologues with eccentric residents of a small Florida town. Morris sees his new film as a real-life episode of The Twilight Zone, where, because of a chance encounter, an innocent man finds himself accused of a murder.
I, of course, told them what happened that Saturday, that I had met this kid. I kept telling them the same thing, the same thing, the same thing. They didn't want to believe me. Never once was I allowed a phone call. Never once was an attorney there. I don't know how long this had been. I know I had smoked 2 packs of cigarettes and had been out for a long time.
There are 2 primary characters in your movie. One is a man serving a life sentence for murder who you believe is innocent. Just tell us a little bit about him.
Randall Adams is a person, I believe, caught in a web of circumstance. He was picked up hitchhiking by a 16-year-old kid one Saturday morning, and as a result, found himself accused of a murder which he did not commit, the murder of a Dallas police officer in 1976. He came within a couple of days of being given a lethal injection in the state of Texas and still is serving a life term for that crime. In the course of investigating the story, I came to believe that Randall Adams was innocent, that he had been telling me the truth from the very beginning, and that David Harris, the 16-year-old kid who was the chief prosecution witness at his trial, had committed the murder.
Your movie ends, and do you mind if I tell a little bit about how it ends?
Not at all.
Okay, your movie ends with an interview with David Harris, the guy who I think you think really committed the crime, the guy who was not serving time for that crime. It ends with an interview with him, and you ask him in that interview if he thinks that Adams is innocent, and he says, I'm sure he is, and you say, how can you be sure? And he says, because I'm the one that knows. Well, that's pretty close to a confession. It's not a confession, but it certainly makes you think he was there, and he knows.
I asked him,
what does this count for in the courts?
I also asked him, is Randall Adams an innocent man?
Yeah.
He said, I'm sure he is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So is this enough to reopen the case?
You would think it would be. I've uncovered so much evidence in the course. You have to remember that in the course of making The Thin Blue Line, although 20 people appear in the film, I interviewed over 200 people. There is an enormous amount of evidence that I've uncovered. All of that evidence points to Randall Adams' innocence and to David Harris's guilt. The question you're asking is, what are people doing about this? What's happening in Texas? What's happening in the courts? The answer is nothing. I am terribly distressed by the failure of the Texas judicial system to deal with this case.
Do you want us to be watching this movie evaluating who's telling the truth the whole time?
Absolutely. This is not a movie designed to tell you what to think. This is a movie designed to set you adrift in a sea of conflicting facts, to put you inside the nightmare, inside the dream.
Do you think of The Thin Blue Line as a documentary?
Yes and no. I think of it as a documentary in the sense that the real people who are involved in this case appear in the film. The killer, the fall guy, the Dallas police, lawyers, surprise, mystery eyewitnesses, so on and so forth. In another sense, it differs from almost every documentary that I know of, both in style and in substance. It breaks with most of the conventions of documentary and of nonfiction filmmaking. And that's one of the reasons why I've called it a nonfiction feature, as opposed to a documentary.
Some of the ways that it breaks with the form of documentaries. When we're hearing an interview and seeing an interview with someone, you will insert footage of a kind of iconographic film noirish type imagery. If someone is talking about a police officer speaking under hypnosis, you see one of those watches going back and forth on the screen. We see the crime enacted in silhouette from several points of view. In talking about the police, you see the rotating gumball on top of the police car. And these images are repeated as the movie goes on. And I'd really like to know why you wanted to do that. Now, a kind of classic documentary filmmaker, a cinema verite filmmaker, would say that is forging it in some way, that it's putting in irrelevant information because it's not the real thing. Why did you want to bring that in?
Well, there is no real thing in filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that disturbs me about cinema verite is the idea that it has some claim to truth. Truth, properly conceived, is never guaranteed by style. Cinema verite is one style among many. The style of The Thin Blue Line is one style among many. Truth, as such, is a quest. I, to this day, can't tell you what really happened on the roadway that night. I wasn't there. All I can do is provide an account of what happened that, in my own mind, squares best with the evidence that I have at hand.
When you're interviewing someone on camera, the camera basically doesn't budge. It doesn't zoom in on their hands if they're doing an interesting gesture. It just basically stays put. And the shots are basically the same for all the characters in the movie. And I wonder why you do that. You know, why that one basic shot?
Well, it goes beyond that even.
Uh-huh.
I filmed everybody using the same chair.
Oh, no. I didn't notice that.
Wherever I went, I took my chair with me. In fact, I would say without the chair, there is no movie. So the chair became a very essential part of my movie making. Everybody sits the same distance from the camera, in the same chair. We use the same lens. I've often been disturbed by the idea of the camera chasing after things. The twitch of a leg, hands rubbing together. The camera in The Thin Blue Line is almost like a bear staring down its subjects. It's there for people to talk to, unmoving, unflinching, undemonstrative in its own way. And as such, I think it takes on an incredible power.
Mm-hmm. You started off making a movie, and now you kind of have someone's life on your hands. And here's what I mean by it. You started off, you know, to make a movie, and now you're convinced that someone who is serving a life sentence is actually innocent, and that someone else who you interviewed is actually guilty. You're perhaps more convinced than anybody is, and you've got a lot of information that you've gathered in your movie. The movie's done. Now what happens with your relationship to the case?
Knowing what I know, it would be irresponsible for me to do anything less than to seek Randall Adams' release and to see him eventually exonerated for this crime.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Errol Morris, director of the new film, The Thin Blue Line. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
How are you recapping the Republican Convention?
Well, we'll have a wrap-up of the politics of the Republican Convention from Linda Wertheimer and Cokie Roberts. But, you know, for my money, the real story to be listening for tonight is a set of reviews we have of both the Republican and the Democratic conventions from Robert Altman, the director who has been on the campaign trail doing Tanner 88, which might be called a docu-spoof for HBO on the primaries, along with Gary Trudeau. Also, we asked Fred DeCordova, who is the producer of The Tonight Show and directed, by the way, Bedtime for Bonzo, what he thought. And we asked the producer of the Miss America pageant, Robert Marks, his views.
Some interesting perspectives. Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Republican convention or not, political stories are on the front page of most newspapers every day of the year. But critic at large Laurie Stone says politics is surprisingly absent from most stand-up comedy acts. There are exceptions, though, and she says Lewis Black is an exception worth listening to.
I recently spent a week in Montreal at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival, and although the organizers invited a number of smart, unconventional comics, there was a conspicuous absence of political humor. That absence has been apparent throughout the comedy circuit. The age of Reagan hasn't exactly been inspiring of activism. Indifference and complacency have been its strong suits. The same can be said for the David Letterman show, which seldom books political comedians, and which, arguably, is the most powerful tastemaker and showcase for comedians in the U.S. If this climate changes, I know at least one political comedian ready for a larger audience. His name is Lewis Black, and he's been doing stand-up in small clubs around the country for 20 years. During the past five of them, his act has been sharpening in New York at the West Bank Cafe, a theater space he co-founded and helps run. His look is 60s. He still wears wire-rimmed glasses and longish hair. His red tie gives the impression someone said, "Lou, you need color." His dark suit looks as if he thought, "I have to make like I'm going to work." Inside his head, the New Left and the sex wars are still alive, too. Print matter and memory are his contexts.
We invaded Grenada in our lifetime, really, to make the Caribbean safe for club meds.
He places newspaper clippings on a stool and reads from them, the way Mort Saul used to in the days before he terminally curdled. But Black isn't smug and pious the way Saul was, even at his best. Black takes corruption personally. His material isn't usually falling down funny, but it's trenchant.
Did you make a list of possible Democratic vice presidential candidates? Did it ever occur to you to pick Lloyd Benson? Did it ever cross your mind? Did Lloyd Benson at any time in the past 5 years cross your mind? George Benson. Now, there's a great choice. That's a great vice presidential candidate. You send him out to some malls, he sings a little.
Sometimes, to get a laugh, all he has to do is read a headline. Bush gets endorsement from Gaddafi. Black's disbelief at the Reagan years chokes him. He chain smokes and sips Rolling Rock beer to keep from flailing his arms at the ruling powers. From time to time, he does just that, turning his back on the audience, seeking consolation from the wall, a Job who doesn't want the job but has a talent for complaint. Reagan, he mutters, adding, he called shooting down the Iranian Airbus an understandable accident. Black goes on, I've never heard those two words used together. If it's an accident, it can't be understandable. A few days after the show, Black and I had lunch. This guy, who almost never smiles when holding a mic, is contented. He's a playwright as well as a comedian. Two secure fields, he calls them. He told me, I finally have control over what I do. Of course, no one is saying, here's $500,000, we want you to work with the SEALs. The thing that makes him happiest is freedom in working. He described his day. Mornings, I read as many magazines and newspapers as I can. I'm on stage 5 or 6 nights a week, so I can be watching the 6 o'clock news and get up on stage at 8:30 that night and talk about what's on my mind. Most of what I do each week is new. Black said he was going to be 40 this month, adding, I'm ready. What more can happen? I was having too pleasant a time to speculate.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we meet William Novak, the writer who collaborated with Lee Iacocca, the Mayflower Madam, and Tip O'Neill on their best-selling autobiographies. Novak's new client is Nancy Reagan. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Letter to South Africa, the new album by pianist Curtis Clark and his quintet. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Aretha Franklin, Queen of Soul, the next American Masters presentation on PBS. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.